Many people thought the Share Your Embarrassment tour was over, but it was just dormant. We are really excited to announce that right now, tickets are on sale for the streaming Cyboctacular. We filmed our Hollywood show last year, and it's going to be streaming starting May 16th and available for a couple of weeks after that to anyone that holds a ticket. And if you have a Max Fun membership, you can get your ticket at a discount. Just check your inbox for an email for Max Fun with that code. If you aren't and would like to see the show, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets today. These shows are really fun. We put a lot of work into high-quality production values. And if you get a VIP ticket, we can even meet face-to-face over the internet. Get your tickets today at greatestgentour.com, and we'll see you on May 16th.
My friends, the great experiment.
The greatest trick.
Would you look at that?
The greatest trick.
And you people, you're all astronauts on some kind of star.
The greatest trick.
Welcome to Greatest Trek. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
It's pilot season.
Today's episode is about a pilot.
Yeah, I guess it is.
Finally!
Couple of pilots in this episode, and yet the episode is named Premiere.
I was just talking to our good friend Ben Fritz about being the youngest people possibly to have a subscription to Premiere magazine. We were talking about print magazines when we were hanging out, and we were talking about all the old subscriptions we used to have, and like, he turned his Premiere subscription into an important writer-editor job.
Wow.
That he has. And I turned mine into gesturing broadly, whatever this is. But you remember how great Premiere magazine was? That large format, that like unusual sized magazine? It was great.
I never got Premiere. I was I got Discover, Wired, and you know, I didn't personally subscribed, but enjoyed the New Yorker that my parents received.
Yeah.
Oh, and I had Rolling Stone for a while.
Over under 8 years old when you had a subscription to the New Yorker.
Oh, I mean, we had it the whole damn time.
Yeah. They lined your crib with it.
Yeah. I was looking at a cartoon in the New Yorker the other day, and I was wondering when Derone is going to waddle up to a New Yorker and open it up and get curious about the cartoons in the New Yorker, if ever.
I mean, it may have already happened.
It's possible, yeah. I mean, clever little kid, let me tell you.
Hey, I mean, he's not that clever. He was throwing a bunch of rocks around at the party we were at Fritz's, so.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those rocks were perfect throw-in size, though, right?
God, they really were. Yeah. I mean, so is Derone, really.
He is, yeah. He's quite tossable.
The boy.
Yeah, we had a baby birthday party at Ben Fritz's house.
Mm-hmm.
But just to reset, we are doing this pilot season project where we're going back through pilots for, you know, mid to late 90s and early 2000s sci-fi shows. Things that were contemporaries of the Star Trek shows that we grew up loving, but maybe didn't necessarily get to see ourselves. And today's episode is about Farscape. Did you read about Farscape in the pages of Premiere magazine? What did it tell you?
Well, Farscape dropped in 1999, so this would have been like smack in the middle of my college years.
Uh-huh.
It seemed to be fairly like omnipresent as a person who had basic cable in the dorms or whatever. Like,
yeah,
this was a show I remember being marketed pretty fiercely, and I can't say that I ever watched a minute of it.
Yeah, I remember it being like kind of a big deal that they were putting as much into a show that was running on cable at the time.
Yeah,
because cable was still kind of the dominion of like reruns of other shit and like extremely low budget shows that were like, you know, on theme with the network. But yeah, Farscape was, I mean, it's a big deal. It was like a collaboration between the Jim Henson Company and Hallmark Entertainment. It had the same creator and showrunner as Sequest. So a little bit of a sci-fi pedigree behind it.
It's got the puppets that Benjamin R. Harrison just loves.
Yeah, and the like slightly silly tone that that entails, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I really remember this like lady that was all gray and had like a very like, you know, like a super short bob that kind of stuck out at the sides being heavily in the marketing. And that character was not in this pilot.
Much like the nudity we were promised in a Stargate SG-1. We did not get the bob girl.
Yeah.
In this ep.
Like all the images I saw when I was like searching for where to watch this episode included her. So I was like, oh, I wonder what her deal is. She seems to be wearing some tight clothing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we don't, who knows?
You're saying this because you were familiar with the marketing materials. You were not a viewer of the show when it was out, right?
I don't think I watched the show when it was out. I think I maybe watched the pilot once before when it was on like Netflix or something.
Do you think that this was a show with the intention to make sci-fi cool? Like, let's talk about those marketing materials a little bit. Let's talk about, like, the previews to the show. Like, this is tight white t-shirt dude surrounded, you know, by adventure and sex.
Like, right.
Is this not the science fiction meant for the normie of its day, you know? Like, I wonder if that wasn't the intention.
I mean, yeah, but also Sci-Fi Network was, like, in those early days of basic cable, I guess this is not really early days, median days of basic cable, like, we were still in a period where, like, the Learning Channel was nominally putting very educational materials out, and A&E Biography was putting out like biographical documentaries, and
now it's like Housewives all the way down,
yeah,
or Vanderpumping everywhere.
Everything is a reality show. Everybody is raiding a storage locker, or you know, towing cars, or making moonshine on cable.
God, what did we do, man?
I know
we used to have it all on basic cable.
I guess what I'm saying is, like, to some extent, basic cable was a little bit more like what podcasting has become, which is like narrowcasting. Like, if you are specifically interested in sci-fi, this is a show that we think you'll like.
That's right. Way to bring it around. Way to make it about us again, Ben.
So, yeah, probably am exactly the demographic they were looking for. I just don't think I had, you know, the time and the space in my brain for another sci-fi show in 1999. But why don't we get into this premiere and see if either of us will make space in our hearts and our viewing rotation for it now.
Well, Pope Ben, let's continue pilot season with season one, episode one of Farscape. It's called Premiere Magazine.
You know the greatest danger facing us is an irrational fear of the unknown.
November 29th, 1999.
Wow. So we open on Cape Canaveral. We're looking out at the shuttle ready to launch with the sun setting behind it.
That's not all you see, though, Ben. Did you see what I would have bet anything were two bad guys waiting to do something to this space shuttle?
No, I didn't.
There are two people in this empty parking lot, like, waiting, you know, with the shuttle rack up in the distance. Like, I wanted to know what these guys' deal was. I thought they were going to, like, try to shoot down the shuttle or something.
Oh, man. I did not see them.
I'm not making them up, right? Like, they were actually there?
I'm trying to rewatch it now because I didn't clock them. We do see our guy, John Crichton, who looks kind of sunburned in the moment because he's got sunset light cast on his face. I don't see other people there.
I know I didn't make this up.
Oh, man.
It's like two dudes sitting on the hood of their car with the shuttle in the distance.
And they look like ne'er-do-wells. They look like they're up to no good?
Well, it looks like either they got there early because you want to get there early to watch a shuttle launch, or
yeah,
they're up to no good, which is what I thought.
You have to get up pretty early in the morning to watch a shuttle launch.
You got to get up pretty early in the morning to get up to no good.
Yeah, yeah.
This is what a cold open's for.
Yeah. I didn't see these guys. Maybe we watched different versions. Did you watch the version that was on the Peacock streaming service?
I did.
Okay. Did you click ne'er-do-wells in background edition or just like director's edition?
I can't explain why why I may have seen two people that weren't there. I swear I'm doing all right.
So, yeah, we're in the locker room where they're getting the astronaut ready. Not a very impressive astronaut suit that they're putting this guy in. Like, just very, like, we went into, like, a Carhartt store and got a full-body jumpsuit and, like, put some fake patches. It's not NASA, it's IASA that is running the space agency that controls the Cape Canaveral launch complex now.
I read that the reason that they couldn't use the NASA name and logo was because they wanted script supervision on this episode and on the show, and they wouldn't grant that.
I would never want to grant that either. I respect that decision.
This is a scene that immediately puts you in a time.
It really does.
Why? The sideburns. These are late 90s sideburns, and it could be no other time than the late 90s when you see these burns.
A dude with these sideburns and one earring is like a specific late 90s dude.
He plays trombone in a ska band.
This is DK, and this is John's best bud / co-worker at NASA. DK is not an astronaut, though. He's just a lab coat. And DK is excited because there's an article in Scientific American about the momentous space mission that John is about to go on. They're going to test their big theory, and Commander Crichton is nervous, and he's got a tingly feeling.
Man, what is wrong with you?
DK's just excited.
You probably know the answer to this, Ben. Does everyone have to quarantine, or just the astronaut ahead of a launch? Like, did DK have to? Did Jack, the dad, have to have this interaction with him?
It seems like you would, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But also, John is, like, not in really any trouble for having broken that quarantine.
That's, yeah. It doesn't seem like a big deal.
So, who knows? Yeah, Commander Creighton's dad is a silver fox that walks in, and we pretty quickly learn that bit of a nepo baby. His dad was also an astronaut who, I guess, was in the Apollo program because he talks about having walked on the moon.
I bet this scene really hits for a lot of folks because the actor who plays Jack was in the original Battlestar and like some other science fiction of note. Like, they really wanted this guy to play Jack. And I think that probably was a hit for some folks that weren't me.
Yeah, I didn't clock him, but that's a great stunt cast. Not stunt cast, but
Jack's got that folksy dad energy that, you know, like, he's this sort of dad that always calls his son, son, as if to patronize, but also convey that, like, he's teaching all the time.
Right.
He always has something important.
Something to pass down. And he's also talking about, like, feelings don't have the names of feelings. They all have colorful metaphors instead. So when they're talking about whether or not John is nervous, it's a conversation about rattlers in the stomach.
Sure. And dad is seen as kind of a hero for his Miriam adventures in space. The son just sort of views this as a very unadventurous scientific mission. And dad's like, son, you're never going to know when adventure strikes. So be ready to be a hero just at any moment. All right? All right, good talk.
Don't try to be a hero, just try to be a man, et cetera, et cetera.
It's rhetorical nonsense.
Don't try to be a hero. Don't try to get out of the space capsule. I love how that's like the main thrust of heroism. Like,
yeah.
I'm not even getting out of the ship. What's going to happen?
I can't be your kind of hero.
No, you can't be.
So within like 3 minutes of this episode starting, the shuttle has launched and we are in space and we get a little voiceover from like, I guess somebody in mission control or something explaining what this experiment is while we watch some CG of the space shuttle like tilting over and releasing this little itty bitty second shuttle from its, you know, its payload area.
That's not the Canada arm. That's the Iannida arm.
Right.
They,
yeah.
Because they couldn't get, they wouldn't grant script oversight from them.
Right. Can't let the nation of Canada determine what your show is going to have in it.
No.
No way.
Did you ever build a space shuttle model when you were a kid?
I didn't build many models. I built an AT-AT model and I built like a remote control car, but I never built many models aside from that and like Legos, you know.
I built a couple of space shuttles and I always really loved the, like, the imagination of what you could keep in that cargo hold. You know, you open up those giant doors. There's so much room back there. Look at all that room. And it's neat to see that room being used for another ship.
Yeah.
In this show.
And so the experiment gets going. The little baby shuttle we learn is called Farscape One. And what he's going to try to do...
They should have called it Premiere. And then they should have called the episode Farscape One.
That's a good call by you.
Yeah.
A little find and replace in the script.
Mm-hmm.
The experiment is something about like... increasing your speed using gravity while in the upper atmosphere. Is that, did I understand that correctly?
Right. Using the gravity to your speed advantage.
Right.
Like not trying to escape gravity, using it.
We get the sense that John was a little nervous about this on the way up because he was like going over, you know, all of the pre-flight checklist stuff with DK. While DK was just trying to show him the Glossy magazine article. Scientific American, I feel like I should have had a subscription to, but I don't think I ever did. I had Popular Mechanics for a minute. That was a cool magazine.
It was probably the American part that got it disallowed from your household. Too narrow.
Yeah. Why are we leaving out all the other kind of scientific people?
Right.
Scientific Frenchman, we did get that one.
It's just a bunch of smoking technologies from from throughout the decades.
Ways to get a perfect crust on your baguette.
Can you imagine the amount of cigarette ads in a Scientific Frenchman magazine? It's just all ads. It's all ads. This is not worth my subscription payment.
You do not have any journalist on staff, only ad sales representative. This is terrible.
I called to cancel my subscription. No one pick up the phone. I'm stuck on hold for hours.
Maybe I called claiming to have cigarette company and want to buy ad space. Then somebody pick up the phone.
Oh, hello.
Pretty bumpy ride.
Yeah.
Once they get the Farscape One going. And the problems start right away. Abort, John. Abort. Even Dad gets on the mic. Dad's like, son, abort.
Listen, I know my homie cornpone accent might make you think I'm anti-abortion, but in this context, I really want you to do it.
Abort now.
Yeah. This does not seem possible because Farscape One hits this wave that John's been warned about, and the ship blurps away.
Yeah. I mean, we knew this was going to happen when we saw his teacup rattle off the edge of the chair in his cockpit and hit the floor, right?
Yeah. I mean, he didn't turn it into the wave. He just sort of incidentally moved into the wave.
Yeah. So he's gone, baby, gone. And I really liked the effect of the wormhole because it kind of looks like an ice tunnel or something he's in. Like it's much cooler looking than the tunnel that we saw in like the Sliders premiere or the Stargate premiere.
It feels like you're getting a little emotional about the Stargate one, but
no, I'm burpy.
I think one of the issues with the Stargate effect is that they kind of had to keep the same effect.
Yeah.
If you change that effect, people would riot.
That's true. That's true. This effect looked awesome to me. And when he comes to, John tries to radio up Cape Canaveral. They're not on the line. They're not picking up the phone. And when he looks out the window, there are like space rocks everywhere. He's in some kind of like asteroid field and there are space fighters flying around. They don't look like they're shooting. They're just kind of zipping about.
I think this is the key moment for John Crichton. If you're going to get on the show's level, if you're going to get on his level, is you've had a little bit of time with him so far to experience, you know, what serious astronaut man John Crichton is about. Up until this point, kind of a chill dude, kind of a guy not blown away by his circumstances, not especially nervous, even though he does have snakes in his tum. Like, yeah. He's just a dude. And when he pops out of this wormhole and he sees these fighter ships and these asteroids and stuff, he cannot freak out. And it's not like he's got a military kind of clamp around his emotions or his curiosity. Mm-hmm. He's kind of just too much of a dope for that.
Yeah.
Like, he's so everyman, he cannot possibly succumb to the wonder of this, you know?
Right. And he just seems confused, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Canaveral?
I think the logic of it is sort of the same as the logic of Luke Skywalker in the first Star Wars movie. Like, you've got to have somebody that doesn't know that much about this bigger world that they're stepping into so that they can kind of be the proxy for the audience and we can be like, oh, like, this is your interesting contexts and stuff.
And crucially, not make them do so much to appear too different from most people watching or to alienate them in any way or whatever. Like, he's a super blank canvas.
Right.
Basically the entire episode.
Yeah, but like, unlike Luke Skywalker, yeah, this guy, there's nothing specific about him at all. Like, it's,
yeah,
we just learned so little about him.
Isn't that interesting when you're trying to like break a show and figure out its essential characters and its themes and stuff, to like choose plot over character to such a degree that the star of your fucking show is intentionally,
yeah,
like super vague.
This space intentionally left blank.
Yeah.
You know.
This character intentionally left blank. I love that.
So we do not get a voiceover in the title sequence explaining what's going on and who this is.
I hear we get that in the second episode. This one.
Oh.
This title intentionally left blank.
Yeah.
From the words. We get, I don't know if you agree, Ben, this like weird atonal theme song to this show kind of made my skin crawl. I did not like it. Like, even though it's probably the most alien sounding thing,
yeah,
that you could use, like, it really feels like a different universe or whatever effectively, but I didn't like it as a theme. What about you?
I would say that the music of this might be the low point music-wise of the stuff we've watched for pilot season so far, like, overall.
If you like Melota, you're probably going to like it. Like, this is on the mixtape for Klingons. Like, you got Melota, and then you get this.
Yeah. When we come back, he's still kind of, like, tumbling around out of control in this asteroid field. He's trying to get his ship stabilized, and one of these fighters comes around on a space rock and clips his wing and explodes. And the chaos in front of his windscreen clears, and he sees this huge ship in space. And this ship really reminded me, in this shot specifically, of the one that's crashed on LV-426.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really look like that in later angles, but
this angle specifically, I was like, oh, it kind of looks like that ship. And he gets brought inside this ship. It's like not totally clear what's going on. Like there's some kind of tractor beam situation, maybe. But yeah, he's brought in to a hangar, and we meet our first puppet of the episode. It's a little like robot guy that lands on the ship and is shining its little light bulb, little mini book light bulb eyes into the canopy to look at him.
It's like a Keanu react would be a 10 in this scene. Like, I bet that there are takes they didn't use where Jack Crichton's like, oh, God!
Whoa! Oh, my God! Oh, my God!
Oh, that ship is enormous! Oh, look at this yellow thing. What is that?
Oh, there's a fire inside the ship that I designed. Oh, no! How will I ever get home now?
He's way more freaked out about the fire in the cockpit than anything else.
Yeah.
Which I guess makes sense. There's like a pregnant half-second pause before he hits the button to blow the canopy where he's like, well, I hope there's air in there. Because this is not a spacesuit of contemporary design where there's like a breathing apparatus or anything. It's like a helmet from Star Wars that he's wearing.
Yeah, it's just like a fighter jock helmet. And yeah, like no comment on like, how am I experiencing gravity? No comment on, well, I've got to risk it and blow this canopy or I will burn to death.
My astronaut diaper is super full.
Let's just say I've got a lot of fuel for that fire in my dumper and I need to get out of here before it catches.
Yeah.
Good news. I'm aboard this ship. I can help you with that over here.
I'm in prison. I love this shot. This post-fire in the cabin scene involves Captain Jack putting out those flames, and we get nose of his ship obscured by something giant in the foreground. Hey,
yeah,
just got to build the front of that ship, just the nose cone. Let's save a little money.
Yeah. That is the kind of economic sci-fi that we really appreciate as viewers.
The most expensive part of that set is like the palette of whatever that's obscuring yeah. the rest of that ship.
They just had to get something really big.
Yeah. No, it's soft focus. It could be anything. Would you look at that? It seems as though there's a number of little droids scooting around this ship. Jack encounters a couple of them.
Yeah, he broke the one that was on his ship, but another one comes and kind of like, I guess it's like holding up a gun and sort of threatening him to go somewhere, right?
It's interesting how like the pantomime of gun is universal, right?
Yeah, even a little like non-humanoid robot can persuade us that it's saying like, move along, bub.
Yeah, there's this nudging of Crichton to the bridge.
Yeah.
Where from behind, he sees two aliens just kind of wrestle with the controls of this thing. They're too busy to notice him at first.
Yeah.
But when they finally do, John does what I'm just going to describe as the Nicolas Cage hello, just kind of like a tight single on his face and sort of a semi-profile, and he kind of does that hand and finger thing next to his head. I feel like Nick Cage has perfected this move.
This is a maneuver I've seen you reproduce to let a rideshare driver know that you are the customer they are looking for.
Love it. It's a cool guy move.
The sound design in this scene is also like very skin crawly. Like it sort of seems like a mixture of weird atonal music and like alien language that we can't understand yet.
Mm-hmm.
And this one big dude comes and lifts John Crichton up by his neck. He's like strangling him, but it's so that his foot is high up enough off the ground, I guess, that the robot can come in and inject his foot with something.
Yeah.
And then something starts to take place where he starts to be able to understand these people. And it's still like, even though they're like now speaking English, they're not really saying things that make sense because he has no context for what things they're saying.
I like how there's a transition state between gibberish and understandable English.
Yeah.
That sounded neat to me.
Yeah, it was neat. And this big, tough alien guy is like, he's kind of giving like hardened criminal in a movie that like will not go back to Folsom under any circumstances. Like somehow he believes that John Creighton is there to try to arrest him or something. So he's like, he's saying a bunch of shit about like, you're never going to take me.
It's interesting how this makes a lot of logical sense in retrospect. Once you realize what type of person John Creighton looks like.
Right. We also like are cutting away to this character Pilot, who occasionally shows up on FaceTime, but seems to be in like some other part of the ship that they don't ever go to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Pilot is working with them on, there's like a control collar that they want to get off and...
That they want to get off the ship,
right?
Specifically.
Yeah. He starts just kind of like digging in the guts of the computer and pulling cables out. And eventually something he does accidentally succeeds. And we see all this like metal shit come off of the ship in space. And you can tell it was like a foreign object because the metal shit is gray and the ship itself is brown. And once it's off, they're like able to make their escape from these marauding space fighters that are trying to kill or capture them. And they do what is called a starburst, which is, I guess, Farscape for go to warp.
With the way that this ship is constructed and what the effect looks like, it looks like that, you know, that super bubble maker that's just like a really long rope dropped into soapy water.
Oh, yeah.
Like these tendrils on the front of the ship kind of make the super bubble.
Yeah.
As if they were being dropped into a bucket of soapy water. I thought that was the effect inspiration. Looked pretty cool.
I love that comparison. Yeah. And I love what the ship looks like when it goes into this hole. Like it kind of like gets this neon glow effect. And then we cut to the mothership that was pursuing them. And it's got a few other ships that kind of look like the one that our heroes are on around it and a bunch of other smaller support craft. And we cut to the inside where we meet a very angry dude named Captain Kreis, who's getting an update on their failed attempt to stop this ship from his subordinate. And she's like, oh, yeah, like a couple of people died. And he's like, I don't give a shit about that. And she's like, well, you should, before you commit to that position, let me tell you about who one of them was. And it turns out that that fighter that bumped into Commander Crichton's shuttle was Captain Kreis's brother, who died during the battle. And Kreis is going to be really, really animated by the fact that his brother died in a senseless tragedy like this for the rest of the episode.
Do you think that when you're creating a show and characters and situations and locations, you should consider when an antagonist's name is so similar to a protagonist's name and the locations are like command carriers, command carrier Captain Kreis and Crichton and like all these C words in this show?
Yeah.
Is that a part of the math at all at any point? I don't know, because I was tripped up a little bit too with all of this stuff.
I think I mentioned this conversation I had with our buddy Chuck Bryant about a pilot writing class that he took, and he was advised that. Like, he had two characters. One was named like Janet and the other was named Jessica or something. And somebody told him like, you should probably not have two characters with the same first letter of their name in your pilot.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope he doesn't take that advice. Chuck, you name him who you want.
Yeah. You do you, Chuck. I think it's Case. I think I added an R where there was no R.
Kreis is the name.
Kreis. Yeah. Kreis.
This guy is about to have an even worse day when he is told about his brother's death. And it makes him so upset he can't put his arms down when he walks. Did you notice this about him? They're just kind of ballooned out a little bit. Like maybe he did an especially difficult shoulder exercise.
Oh.
And now he's just kind of like puffy, like full of the lactic acid or something.
I was wondering if just his costume like wouldn't allow him to relax his arms, or maybe he's just kind of like, he was like a Napoleon Dynamite type in high school and never really grew out of it.
Sure. So between the death of his brother and the loss of this transport that got away on his watch, it's shaping up to be a pretty bad one for Captain Kreese.
Yeah, whoever's in charge of the Starfleet that he participates in as a captain is going to be pretty pissed at him. He's basically failing on all fronts.
If you had video footage, I know you don't have any siblings, but like if you did, and there was video footage of their untimely death, I would bet anything that you wouldn't want to watch that video. Captain Kreese, as a character, like wants to watch this video, enthusiastic to watch this video, maybe over and over again even.
Yeah.
I think that tells you a lot about him.
I agree. That tells you a lot that you're going to need to know about him.
Yeah.
So we cut over to Moya, which is the name of this ship, coming out of Starburst. And they're through, but we see that one of these fighter planes that was chasing them has tumbled into the hole behind them.
Oh.
So they got to get that ship and get its pilot aboard.
We get a moment where the aliens on the stolen ship get to know each other. The lady is a priest.
Mm-hmm.
Whose name is Zahn. The red dude is D'Argo, who states that he's a warrior.
I wrote Ka-D'Argo.
It's Ka-D'Argo.
Ka-D'Argo?
And he's referred to as D'Argo for much of the episode.
Okay.
And she has an interesting reputation to him.
Yeah.
She seems to be able to do some really sexy stuff that they don't quite articulate. And his magical power is that he killed his captain. And
yeah,
those may be the reasons that they're in the prison circumstance to begin with.
It is that, like, what are you in for prisoner conversation? And, like, it's pretty intense that it's, like, political prisoner meets literal murderer.
I think it is hilarious how not coincidental the whole, hey, we were at the same prison labor camp. Isn't that wild? How about that?
I was just amazed that Zahn was like, it seemed like she was kind of horny for him after he told her the thing about murdering his commanding officer.
She did have that kind of tongue ring energy of like, yeah, this is me. This is what I'm about.
Yeah. D'Argo also seems to have some kind of like thing where he can like shoot his tongue at you and knock you out. Which he has done to John Crichton, who wakes up a little later in a cell and meets the other puppety alien, aside from Pilot, who introduces himself as Rigel the 16th.
Domino to over 600 billion people. I don't need to talk to you.
He was in jail because of some royal set tripping shit where he was like deposed and replaced by a pretender. And I love this alien design. Like this puppet is so expressive and like definitely there to be like the silly guy on the show in the way that a puppet character often is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He was operated by so many puppeteers too to get him to work. Like there's a lot of people off screen making this happen, reaching their arms up into things.
It's really impressive. So he's kind of like talking through the bars of this jail cell that John Crichton wakes up in. And he's like dicking around with some controls on the wall while they talk. And Crichton is like, you know, what are you doing? Like, why did you lock me up? And he's like, well, you're like obviously with the guys that were trying to kill us. So we don't trust you. Or at least we thought you were until we figured out that you're not the same species as them. Anyways, we put the translator microbes inside your birdie, and now we're just kind of trying to figure out what to do with you. Because, I mean, you got to admit, you do look a lot like them. And he's like, who are the them that you're talking about? And he indicates across the cell, and we see a motorcycle bad guy. Oh, no!
They take off their helmet in slow motion, and oh, my God, she is gorgeous.
I thought it was really cool that there was a like a wooden staircase for her to come down
in
this jail cell, you know?
That was neat. And like wearing a dress underneath the fighter pilot uniform
mm-hmm.
seems difficult, But she pulls it off.
It's amazing that she can go from piloting a fighter to prom without missing a beat, you know?
She's got a hell of a handshake. She really kicks the shit out of John Crichton here.
She does. She beats the fuck out of him.
What is your rank and regiment? And why are you out of uniform? Rank and regiment now.
She does not know yet that they're not the same species. Did you notice she had the same, like, super tightly wrapped up ponytail as Captain Krace?
I did not notice that. Wow. Yeah. Good catch.
I guess that's something that they do in their species.
That makes a ton of sense.
They're like Sebaceans or something, right? I feel like their species is named after a kind of cyst.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure that'll come up later.
We need to score a lot of land fast.
We're licensed businessmen.
What's stopping you from doing something you've never done before? For most people, it's knowing how that holds you back. Many people don't want to try a new thing for fear of not doing it right. And a website is a very public thing. On the biggest stage, the internet. What will people think when you've made something that was designed to represent you? Well, that's the whole point of Squarespace, because they make it so easy to look like you know what you're doing. They've got a guided design system made to make complete web design noobs look like seasoned pros. When all the layout and styling options are templatized and ready to go, you'll be making your brand or business look its best, no matter what. And if you want to sell things on your brand new website, you don't have to know anything first. Squarespace has all the payment tools that you need to start doing business right away. So go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/trek to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Soundheap with John-Luke Roberts is a real podcast made up of fake podcasts, like if you had a cupboard in your lower back, what would you keep in it?
So I'm going to say mugs.
A little yogurt and a spoon.
A small handkerchief that was given to me by my grandmother on her deathbed.
Maybe some spare honey?
I'd keep batteries in it. I'd pretend to be a toy.
If I had a cupboard in my lower back, I'd probably fill it with spines.
If you had a cupboard in your lower back, what would you keep in it? Doesn't exist. We made it up for Soundheap with John-Luke Roberts. An award-winning comedy podcast from Maximum Fun, made up of hundreds of stupid podcasts. Listen and subscribe to Soundheap with John-Luke Roberts. Now.
Oh my gosh, hi, it's me, Dave Holmes, host of the pop culture game show Troubled Waters. On Troubled Waters, we play a whole host of games, like one where I describe a show using a limerick, and our guests have to figure out what it is. Let's do one right now. What show am I talking about? This podcast has game after game, and brilliant guests who come play him. The host is named Dave. It could be your fave, so try it. Life won't be the same.
Big Business, starring Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin.
Close, but no.
Oh, is it Troubled Waters, the pop culture quiz show with all your favorite comedians?
Yes, Troubled Waters is the answer
to this question and all of my life's problems.
Now, legally, we actually can't guarantee that, but you can find it on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're wearing a helmet in any context, tying your hair back has got to be part of the deal, right?
I think so, yeah. I mean, they shave your hair when you get in the military for, like, bugs, right? It's like a keeping, like, fleas and shit off of you.
They didn't shave Aaron's son's head before she enlisted. She gets to keep her hair.
She is pretty pissed about having been locked up. Kazan come down. Gang's all here.
And the prisoners get all their stuff back. It's clear that, like, when they boarded the ship, they had to turn in all their personal effects. And outside the cell, they've gotten all their stuff back. Like,
yeah,
D'Argo, like, gets a giant sword.
That was the control that that Rigel was working on mm-hmm. that whole time. He finally cracked the code or whatever. They get all their stuff.
One does not simply break out of prison without a sword. Didn't you get that vibe from him?
Yeah.
It is folly.
If you're going to have a sword in a science fiction show, I don't know. There's something very Lord of the Rings feeling about this at this point.
Well, that's an interesting comparison. I kept thinking Dungeons and Dragons. Like, there's the priestess character. There's the like the barbarian character in Ka. Mm-hmm. They're like, I don't know. I don't know if it like maps perfectly onto D&D, and I don't know enough about it yet to make the comparison more sophisticated than that. But I kind of got the feeling that like we're putting together a team of different kinds of weirdos, and we have a big bad for them to face in Krace.
But first, chow time.
Mm.
So they're kind of perp walked into the mess hall at this point, and we cut over to Captain Krace watching the footage of his brother's death on a loop over and over and over again. And they're able to punch in and enhance who the pilot of this ship is.
Yeah. And he's jacking off.
I mean,
like, Krace, what, like, that is a weird kink, man.
He was very close to death for a moment. The relief has got to be incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Captain Krace is willing to go rogue to bring this guy to justice. That's the main takeaway of this scene. Like, he commands this giant space carrier, and it seems a little beneath their mission to, like, go after one guy. But that's just what they're going to do.
Yeah. We get the scene where they're all eating. Aaron steals a fork, slides it up her sleeve, and we learn that the ship has leaked a bunch of special liquid that it needs because of all the damage that Ka did when he was trying to get the control collar off. So they're flying to a like a port where they can do some trading to replace this fluid that they're low on. You know, there's a lot of bickering about what to do and like what the next step should be. But replacing this fluid is a risk that they all agree is necessary to take.
Rigel farts helium. That's the main point of this entire scene. Sure, everything you said is important, Ben, but sure. Rigel farting helium is like the central element of this scene and maybe the entire episode, maybe the entire series, Ben, because
I thought about that.
Someone in the writer's room came up with this idea, and the writers thought it was great. What if one of these aliens farted helium?
What is that? It's a perfectly natural bodily function. And it's odorless.
I wondered, how often does this come into play? Is there one scene per episode where everybody's voice gets really high?
Or is Rigel going to demonstrate an awful body thing in every episode that's different?
Yeah, because he did sneeze that, like, maroon snot all over John Crichton's face in the earlier scene.
Yeah, a moment before a tongue took him down and KO'd him. Like, that was a bad moment for him.
Darwin liked that moment. Darwin would like to see more of same in this series.
What a weird moment.
Yeah.
There's nothing like a scene of flatulence to indicate that this is a show that is not hard sci-fi, like that is not hard war sci-fi especially, right?
Yeah. And like at this point, like John Crichton has been here for a while and like has made like a couple of kind of half-hearted comments about like, this is the first time anybody from my species has encountered alien life. But again, like he is the black hole in all of these scenes. Like all of these characters are way more interesting and fully fleshed out than he is at this point. Like it's weird that he's the central character given how much more the show seems to be interested in everyone else.
I'm not done with the fart thing, Red. Could we, for the purposes of this hypothesis, agree that maybe for a lot of people, Star Wars is like the paragon of science fiction movies or television. Let's just pretend that could be true. There's never been a fart in Star Wars, though, right?
Oh, man. Has there ever been a fart in Star Wars?
This is what I'm trying to get at. Like, is there not a line that farting crosses?
Does Jabba the Hutt never fart? I guess he burps.
See, now we're drawing a distinction between types of flatulence.
Right, yeah.
I don't know. I just feel like once there's a fart in your show, that's who you are.
Mm-hmm. You're a fart show. We're a fart show.
That's what I'm saying. That's why we could never be seen as a serious Star Trek podcast.
No. Would never want to be seen as a serious Star Trek podcast.
No way.
But like that also comes on the heels of like this establishing shot of the planet and like a couple of moments when they go down to the planet where like you do get that moment of wonder where like this is like maybe my favorite part of the episode is when John does stop and go like, holy shit, I'm on an alien planet right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the establishing shot was beautiful. It was like a really neat looking alien city that didn't look like a Star Wars city or a Star Trek city. It looked like its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we get this like crazy insect alien with like a billion teeth coming out of its mouth, negotiating with Rigel over this stuff that they have to get for their spaceship.
Production-wise, this is easier to pull off at night, right?
Yeah.
Like I was thinking about what a favor night does for a scene like this and how much, like getting back to the Star Wars thing, how much Star Wars science fiction occurs during the daylight. And what a sense of wonder that conveys.
Yeah.
For that reason, you know?
Totally. I guess I jumped ahead. They do escape, and it was John stealing a fork, not Aaron, that enables their escape. And there's like some debate about this, what to do. Like, Aaron is like, you got to come with me, and we're going to go back and find the peacekeepers, and, you know, and everything will be okay. And he's like, but the peacekeepers seem to be the bad guys. Like, I haven't even seen the, like, very Nazi-like costuming of the people on the mothership, but I am convinced that they're the bad guys all the same. But Aaron convinces him to go with her, and they fly to the surface of the planet and, like, radio it in.
Well, that description's interesting to me because, like, it feels less about convincing him to go with her and more about, like, what other team could John possibly be on? Like, he doesn't really like the circumstances. He doesn't really like how Aaron shits on him all the time. But like, what other choice does he have? Like, he can't be alone. I think that's what's so crucial about his deal on the show in this episode is like, he's like how you described a baby a while ago. Like, like John Crichton is nothing without the other people around him.
Totally.
To help him exist.
The bad guys are headed to this planet. They'll be here any minute. And meanwhile, Rigel is negotiating and Zahn and Ka are doing their work. And they all kind of meet up in a town square and a bunch of motorcycle bad guys show up with Captain Krace, who is just as pissed as he's been the entire episode. And
Crichton's like, hey, there's a Captain Krace behind you. And Dargo's like, what do you think? I'm an idiot or something? Like, that's the stupidest shit I've ever heard. And yeah. Captain Krace is actually behind him.
Ugh, brutal.
Yeah.
The greatest trick.
Pretty weak combat scene between Ka Dargo and these motorcycle bad guys. Mm-hmm. Pretty disappointed in the skills of a warrior, of our warrior character. But this scene goes really bad for everybody that's been on the ship. Because not only is Krace arresting Dargo and John Crichton, but he also chooses to arrest Aaron, who he implies has been like contaminated by being in the presence of aliens for as long as she has.
I like Aaron in this scene, who's like, I'm just a soldier. Like, I got nothing to do with this. And also, I think you might be wrong about John Crichton murdering your brother, because look at him. He's stupid and dopey.
He's too much of a coward and too dumb to do a murder.
Yeah, that seems impossible, right? Like, she's making total sense. This is the moment where I really turn on Captain Krace, though. Like, she's making all the sense in the world, and he's too, like, tunnel-visioned onto revenge to pay her any mind. And so Captain Krace just kind of loops all three of them into the same group and arrests all of them.
Yeah, she gets cuffed. Just like everybody else. And so then they're in like some kind of prisoner processing area with a couple of guards that have balaclavas over their heads. And these are just classic dumb jail guards that you meet in, you know, the beginning of a D&D campaign, for example. They are easily overpowered. All it takes is a little puzzle to trick them.
The puzzle being the ring that John Crichton's dad gave him for good luck. Here's a question. Did he lose this ring in this hallway fight? Or was he able to get it back? There was no like punch in to the ring being grabbed during the scuffle or anything. It made me wonder whether or not it was gone.
And there's no like shot of, you know, this episode is so abrupt in so many ways. Like there's no like shot of him, you know, having done a voiceover about like, well, you know, maybe I'll figure out a way to make a wormhole and get back someday. But for now, this is my new life. And then like pulling out from the ring hanging around his neck, you know, as he like looks out over the vista of some distant space nebula on the bridge of the ship.
You could do an entire act of a show based on the idea of three handcuffed people and one of them having the keys and you can't unhandcuff yourself.
And the gun being present and like them not really trusting each other. Like none of the three of them trust each other in this moment. And
this could be Reservoir Dogs. Like this could be really hard.
Yeah.
We're supposed to be fucking professionals.
But it happens so fast.
It happens really fast. They decide to team up and they convince Erin to go with them because she's, you know, she's fucked if she stays with the peacekeepers. They're just going to kill her.
D'Argo doesn't seem happy that she's coming along, like, at all. That's going to be a problem, I think.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to get along great. So they get back to the ship and they learn that that Krace's ship is right on top of them, chasing them. It's got these frag guns that will be in range very soon, but their ship isn't as fast and they aren't going to be able to go to starburst in time. Like it has to recharge for a long time after each starburst.
Yeah, you just can't rope around bubbles anytime you want. You got to load up your rope.
Yeah, it's in its starburst refractory period.
Yeah.
But John Crichton, brilliant scientist, gets a pen and starts writing equations down on the floor of the ship to reproduce the thing that they were trying to do in his experiment, which is overcoming atmospheric friction to speed up, basically. He like writes the equation down and like under fire, they put this into action and like, you know, a lot of arguing over who's going to be like manning the controls while this happens.
You could break the show right here, right? Because in order to get on the show's level, you've got to believe somehow that a modern human being would be able to hang with future alien folks intellectually.
Yeah.
In any kind of way. Like, because I feel like
they've spent like so much of the show talking about like, this guy must be like tragically low IQ. Like he seems super stupid to them.
A spacefaring civilization compared to us right now. They got to look at what he's scrawling on the floor and it must look like dick butt or something. Like, what the fuck is that, you idiot? But somehow you've got to believe, somehow, Ben Browder as John Crichton will make you believe that he can get on their level intellectually with whatever he's scrawling on the ground.
And also that Erin soon has to be the pilot because she's the experienced pilot, even though there's a character named Pilot on the ship whose job also is pilot.
Yeah. It does not seem as though Erin is used to the controls here, which looks like a late 90s rollerball mouse. Like, I mean, what else could it be? It looks like a spray painted mouse.
That is all it is. And starts strafing the top of the atmosphere of this planet. I thought all of the exteriors of the ship and stuff, like, you know, it's a little bit aged CG, but I thought it all looked really neat. And I loved the kind of muted color palette of it and everything. The equation works. They reach breakaway speed and get away from the bad guys to the extent that they're off their scanners. And boy, Krace just looks fucking furious.
It's important to show gratitude in a moment like this when you're able to get away.
Yeah.
Gotta thank John Crichton with a great big hug that makes him bust if you're Zahn, right? Like, this is a demonstration of her magical powers.
Yeah. Yeah, the camera doesn't pan down to show the little wet spot in his trousers, but the eyes rolling back in the head really kind of indicate that that's what happened, right?
Yeah. Yeah, weird scene. It's all you get. There's no payoff to whatever this is.
I kind of thought that this was going to go in a Sliders direction, like that when they reproduced the experiment, they were going to go through another wormhole and end up another totally random place. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of glad that they didn't. Like, I'd rather like build a coherent world in the new place that he went to. Because it's not quite the same thing. It's not just like Earth, but, you know, the 49ers won the Super Bowl or whatever. It's a different like alien context every week, if that's what the show winds up being about.
I was wondering whether or not this was like a hug goodbye, because the next scene, John Crichton looks packed up and ready to go, right? He's got all his gear in a duffel.
Yeah.
The ship is leaving peacekeeping jurisdiction. And that seems pretty important to know here, because Captain Kreis is on such a mission of revenge that it's not like being out of his jurisdiction is going to matter at this point.
It's almost like Kreis has gone and kind of gotten the names of all the people he wants to kill and put John's right at the top and made sort of a Kreis list.
Yes. Yes, I like that.
I didn't really get the thing of like recording a tape for his dad, because I guess it's like I'm never going to be able to send this to you, but this is how I'm going to do my diary. Like, he's like fixing the robot that he broke when he first showed up on Moya and unpacking the crazy day he just had.
Don't know where I am. Technically, I don't know how I got here, but I'm not going to stop trying to get home.
I think it makes a lot of sense if you assign a little more. This sounds like such a dunk. Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense if you think John Crichton is interesting in any way.
Right.
Because this seems like the behavior of someone who has been traumatized by these circumstances and wants to like center themselves on something familiar. Like, this is fucking crazy. I'm surrounded by aliens. I'm on a spaceship. All of these things have happened. But what I do have is this mini cassette recorder. Like, what I can do is I can do these little vocal diaries or like letters to my dad or whatever, and that's gonna like ground me. It's gonna make me feel like I'm still myself in this weird place.
It's like Norm Macdonald in Dirty Work.
Remember, no matter how bad life gets, there is always beer.
Except in that entire description, none of John Crichton's behavior supports that theory up until now. It just seems like a random thing that he's doing, because he still has time on that tape. Might as well burn it.
He seems so unalarmist that even though he has gone through a wormhole and has found himself in an alien context set upon on all sides by murderous, psychopathic aliens that are convinced that they need to kill him, he's just like, yeah, this doesn't seem that remarkable to me.
Yeah. Did this pilot episode of Farscape seem that remarkable to you, Ben? Did you like it?
Boy, I have such mixed feelings about this, because so much about it I do like. I basically like everything about it but the John Crichton character and the music.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that those two things are such a piece of grit in this oyster.
Ooh.
I hope they turn into a pearl.
Uh-huh.
I think there's 4 seasons of this show, and it seems like, I know a lot of people really love this show, so...
I don't know anyone who loves this show. I don't know anyone who's watched this show. You really know people?
I didn't say I know specific people. I said, I know people love this show.
I see.
And there's got to be a reason for that. And if we are judging all sci-fi series by their pilots, then, like, Star Trek The Next Generation gets kicked off the island very early as well, because it has a very uneven, weird pilot that... you know, fails to fully imagine what all of its characters can ultimately become in so many ways. But yeah, like putting this guy in the middle of it when everything else about the show seems so much more interesting is like such a strange choice.
Yeah.
And I love puppet shit. I love the aesthetics of this show. I love that it just looks like nothing else but itself. And
very, very true. Yeah.
That's got to be so hard when you're making sci-fi. Like, I heard an interview with the director of Ex Machina, mm-hmm. and he talked about how hard it was to design robots that didn't kind of remind you of a different robot in a different sci-fi thing. Like, any time in iterating on what the robots would look like in Ex Machina.
I would just say Alicia Vikander. Like,
yeah.
How about you do that?
How about like a topless dime? How about that?
Not me, mister. This is a Mercedes.
No, but like anytime they put gold, it would kind of like be like, it's a bit C-3PO.
Yeah.
Like there's so few areas that haven't been explored in terms of like how a sci-fi thing can look.
Isn't that a weird irony? Like space is the infinite thing.
Yeah.
There should be no end to the different combinations that you can make. And yet, like, you see derivations of the same all the time.
Yeah. So I am here for this because of what a unique thing it wound up appearing to be. And I read that it was, like, very abruptly canceled after the fourth season. Like, they
made a mistake in the fourth season.
I don't know what happened, but like they had planned on finishing in season 5 and they just got the hammer came down right at the end of season 4. So the series ends on like a huge cliffhanger apparently.
Uh-huh.
And people were really mad about it. And Brian Henson wound up buying the rights to Farscape and making like a 3-hour miniseries to tie up all the loose ends because, you know, it was just so brutal for fans of this show.
You know what I love about that story is Brian Henson was like, they're my fucking puppets. I decide when the story's over.
Yeah.
And he went and did it.
Yeah.
That rules.
Another fun tie-in with pilot season before we get to whether you like this pilot. I read that Ben Browder and Claudia Black, John and Aaron, became series regulars on Stargate SG-1 during mm-hmm. its final 2 seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And they did some bits about Farscape in SG-1.
That's great. Yeah. I love it when science fiction shows talk to each other.
Yeah. Like that. Yeah. So would you take this to series, Adam? Does this feel like it's ready to go?
I keep going back to how safe the John Crichton character is from jump. And it seems like a really cynical kind of buy this and take it to series kind of choice by making him so like such a blank, such a proxy for anyone. I don't know. Maybe there's a limit to that. Like to a certain extent, every pilot of any television show must seek to like attract and not alienate and sort of present a character that you could become if you were in those circumstances. And maybe it's just so much more obvious here than in other cases for some reason.
Yeah.
That it just sort of like, it should be less detectable than this. And I think that's my main hang up with the show. It sure does have potential for how little ground gets covered here. I mean, this is basically a fish out of water, accidental death, revenge type storyline that is mid-interesting as a start to any story. But it's going to take John becoming a lot more interesting to hold a person's attention, you know? And I just wonder how soon that starts to develop. Because I don't know if you could have this version of John for too much longer.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm glad I finally saw a thing that was so popular for so long. Like, this is definitely a type of science fiction show that is, you know, like, name 5 science fiction shows. This is going to be one of them that's named.
I feel like you've got a point. Like, it made a cultural impact.
Yeah.
Even though it's not, like, top of mind for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting pilot, and Let's see if there's anything interesting in the Priority One inbox. What do you say?
On my way there.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Adam, our first P1 is from Chris. It's to Adam and Ben. Goes like this. Will you guys each take a crack at your best Boimler scream? Then will you both finish the rest of the show as Charles Bronson? I overmodulated there. Let me get a little further back.
And no.
No way.
You can't pimp me into doing my Charles Bronson the rest of the show. You only get this. This is all you get. It's all you deserve.
Wow. Thanks, Chris.
Our second Priority One message comes from Potato Dan. It's to Shannon from City Bar. Their message goes like this. Grats on reaching TNG S3. Not long ago, you, disinterested at best, agreed to join me, the kind of guy who sends vintage lamps to podcasts, on a couple's viewing of Greatest Gen from episode 1. Was Potato Dan the one who sent the Porsche lamps to us?
Oh, yeah. Must be. I got pretty far down the road of repairing the mechanism that mm-hmm. keeps the lamp up, and mm-hmm. then got distracted due to the presence of a small child at my house. Mm. I'm going to get that thing fixed. I'm going to get it working again.
You heard it here, Potato Dan. 17 years from now, we will have working Porsche lamps.
16 and a half.
Message continues. With Pulaski behind us, I can finally believe it's real. Ben and Adam have made my wife an FOD on the strength of the Santa Monica Mountains theme song. Scarves earned.
Wow. So Potato Dan and Shannon from City Bar read to me. Let me know if you agree with this. They sort of read to me as what they put into their cell phones when they exchanged phone numbers for the first time.
Oh, I like that a lot. That is great headcanon.
Because I was always Ben Bedford in my wife's phone for years because I lived off Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn. And sometimes she still calls me that to be sweet.
You sure that wasn't Ben Bedford? As in, like, in the bedroom, you're as reliable as a Ford automobile?
I'm pretty sure just because she put me in there as that before we started dating.
Okay.
By a few months. So she would have had to have gotten it from somebody else. Mm. Well, maybe I'm saying too much, but there really wasn't anybody else to be getting that kind of information from.
Uh-huh. Well, if you would like to somehow conjure up a story like that from me or Ben, write a Priority One message. You can do that over at MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. They're a great way of supporting the show week to week. And with new Star Trek coming just around the corner, you're going to want to make sure that your messages are read when new Star Trek starts to drop. So get in there.
Truth.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did a character in the show seem a little off or weird or strange or whatever? They're the characters we call the Edward Larkins. Did you find yourself an Edward Larkin?
Edward Larkin!
Nigel the 16th, man. Fart helium.
God, that's hard to beat.
It's like, not only is he like the comic relief character, but like, God, I was just so impressed with that puppet. Like, Pilot is also an impressive puppet because Pilot has a whole bunch of arms that are doing stuff and a very like well-articulated face and mouth. But Rigel's expressiveness is really unparalleled. Like when there's that little like kind of silly moment at the end where he's like trying to steal John Crichton's toolkit or something and, you know, asks him if he's a light sleeper.
Uh-huh.
Like the look on his face that like wry, like I'll get you someday, John Crichton. so specific and on character. Like, the design of the character, like, works with the voice. The way it's performed as a puppet is, like, funny. And, like, it, the facial expressions it can hit are the ones that they are writing for and stuff. I mean, I think that, like, any Muppet is somewhat similar. Like, Kermit can do, like, perturbed face because you can scrunch up Kermit's head around your hand.
One of the great faces.
Yeah, but like, but there are things that you can't do with Kermit. And God, this character did so much over the course of the episode that I thought was really delightful and impressive and cool. And I love that they're like unafraid to get it like messy. Like, there's a scene where Rigel's eating where he's like putting like goo in his mouth. And it's like, it's fucking sick, but it's also amazing.
Yeah, there are things done to puppets in this episode that would make Will Wheaton go crazy.
I'm gonna accept your apology, Larry.
Ben, my Edward Larkin has to do with the fact that this show was like an Australian cast primarily. Like, it was an Australian production.
Yeah.
And that interested me greatly, because you don't get a ton of Australian accents in this episode. And I started digging into the cast list, and I was like, oh my God, one name really caught my eye. Murray Bartlett plays DK, and he is not recognizable to me at all in this episode. Young Murray Bartlett with those giant sideburns. Who knew Murray Bartlett would one day go on to poop in a suitcase or be in like an amazing episode of The Last of Us, like one of the best episodes of TV. Like, he's a great actor who's done a lot of things. And it just made me think about the decades of science fiction character bit parts that have existed for so long. The thousands upon thousands of DKs there have ever been in a science fiction show. And for how many actors, that's where their story kind of peaks, you know? You play the brother of the main character or whatever. You play the weird alien lady. Like, that's your story. That was the time when you were an actor. And it's useful to remember that, like, the science fiction industrial complex creates careers for people.
It really does.
And sometimes long and celebrated careers. And it was just a neat reminder to, like, watch a show that was this old, see a Murray Bartlett and be like, oh yeah, like, this was a start for some people. So, like, not an especially, like, Larkin-y Larkin, but, like, I wanted to use my time for that, Your Honor.
I really like that. I wondered about Lieutenant Teague for the same reason. Like, she kept catching my eye. She's just got, like, such a striking face. And every time I saw her, I was like, man, I bet she went on to do stuff. And I mean, she's been on a ton of television, but you know, she's not like a household name or anything. But yeah, household names do come out of the sci-fi industrial complex, and we stand a legend in Murray Bartlett.
Yep. You want to do a warning bois and then get the hell out of here?
Yeah, let's do a warning bois and then tell people what our next pilot is going to be. And then we can shut it down for the day.
Prepare a buoy and launch it when ready.
Warning buoys.
An emergency buoy.
A warning buoy.
This is a warning buoy that a YouTube channel called Low Value, and that's spelled L-O-W-E-V-A-L-U, animation, Low Value Animation. This channel did like a whole, like, kind of similar to the style of Star Trek Lower Decks, I would say, a whole animation of you and me doing a little segment about a flashback that BLT had in an episode of Voyager. And as of this recording, the two of us got to watch this morning. And it's like, I can't describe the experience. It is like so tickling to see like so much work and love go into making an animation of some silly bits that you and I did.
Yeah, like one of the most rewarding parts of this project is like people making things out of our thing. And that's what this is. This is a really great piece of animation. It was like of a very funny moment in a specific episode. search it out. Check it out. Maybe we'll put the link in our show notes.
Yeah, check out Low Value on YouTube and subscribe. Ton of cool stuff. And really nice to see all of the little Easter eggs in the episode. And, you know, they ran some filters on it to kind of make it look like, you know, 90s television effects. So it feels like it's right there in the era of Voyager 2. So good. It gave me goosebumps to see something so awesome made out of something that we made.
Yeah, pretty great. Thanks for that.
Okay, Adam, next up on the pilot season list, we're going back to Roddenberry. Got to go back to Roddenberry a few times over the course of this experience.
Spare the rod, spoil the podcasters, I guess.
Yeah, this is a show called Andromeda. The pilot episode is called Under the Night, and you can watch this on Prime Video with ads, apparently, or just find it on YouTube. This is not an unsuccessful television show, Adam. They made 110 episodes of this show, Andromeda. The pilot episode, Under the Night, is described as follows. The Commonwealth vessel Andromeda, captained by Dylan Hunt, responds to a distress call, only to find it's a trap. Warships surround them and open fire. In a last-ditch attempt, Captain Hunt evacuates the ship, and it gets trapped in the gravity well of a black hole, where time slows dramatically. Centuries later, a scavenger party wants to pull the ship from its position, but they're not counting on there being anyone left aboard.
Huh.
So it's a jumping vastly forward in time story, which kind of feels not super dissimilar from how Farscape starts off.
Oh, yeah.
You know, strangers in a strange land, I guess, will be the vibe.
Sounds like it.
And, you know, Kevin Sorbo is the star of this show. So,
hell yeah. Awesome. They're not going to make him get a haircut.
No.
The whole reason you cast Kevin Sorbo is for hair.
Yeah.
He's a hair and chest guy.
He's a hair and chest guy and a no other kind of guy. So that'll be next week on Greatest Trek. Really looking forward to it. Really looking forward to the upcoming Max Fun Drive. Get ready to support the show. In the meantime, we're going to leave this episode in Wendy's capable hands.
You know, I have to admit, I too feel like a hair and chest guy.
Oh, yeah.
If I'm just being honest.
Mm-hmm. You're a hair, chest, and ass guy. You're a triple threat.
Greatest Trek is an Uxbridge Shimoda podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. It's hosted by Ben Harrison and Adam Pranica, and it's produced and edited by Wendy Pretty. Next week on pilot season, it's Andromeda Episode 1, titled Under the Night, and the USS Hood Discord server is still hosting a handful of weekly watch parties for these shows. You can join in with other FODs over at drunkshimoda.com. Thanks to Adam Ragusea, who composed the theme music for Greatest Trek. Go check out what he's up to on YouTube by searching for Adam Ragusea. Thanks to Nick Ditmore for creating the show art. And thanks to Bill Tilley for managing all of the At Greatest Trek social media pages. Make sure you find and follow those online. And use the hashtag Greatest Trek when you post about the show. And thanks to the MaxFun members who contribute directly to keep this audience-supported show going strong. Members get something new in the bonus feed every single month, and we appreciate everyone who sets up a membership at MaximumFun.org/join. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on Greatest Trek.
Maximum Fun,
a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows
supported
directly by you.